Please go ahead.
Thank you, Saba. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's IRTP call on Tuesday, the 14th of September. We have Michaela Nalon, Bob Mountain, James Bladel, Mike O'Connor, Kevin Erdman, Barry Cobb, Paul Diaz, Chris Chaplow, Barbara Steele. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Pam Little, Dan Holleran, Mike Zupke, myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and we have apologies from Baudouin Chambet, Michael Collins, and Glenda Saint-Géry. If I can please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Michaela.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. And thanks for those of you who are getting up, who got up especially early or in the middle of the night in order to attend the call today. It is appreciated. As you can see on the agenda today, we have exchange of views with ICANN staff. Exchange of views means a discussion, possibly getting them to explain how they view things and try not to attack the ICANN staff. Be nice to them. And that includes you, Mikey. We have Pam Little, who is currently the head honcho when it comes to contractual compliance. Mr. Daniel Halloran, who is the Deputy General Counsel for ICANN, and Mike Zupke, who was one of the overworked and stressed registrar liaison managers. Do I get brownie points for that, Mike?
You do, but they're not worth much. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. Well, I had to ask. Okay, so if it would be helpful possibly probably Pam is the one who's in the oddest time. Let's take Pam first, and if Pam could have a look at the charter question E and give us her thoughts on this, it would be appreciated.
Sorry, can you remind me what the question was again? Sorry.
Oh, sorry. This is in relation to our charter question E. This is all to do with the concept of readily accessible and reasonable means. We're talking about lock statuses and removing locks from domain names.
Right. Sorry. I just all of a sudden escaped my mind.
That's okay. It's probably the middle of the night there, so you're forgiven.
Thank you. When the inquiry came to us, we gave some thought about this particular provision, and I think the working group has, you know, considered or has some looked at our response and had some feedback. So basically, I personally feel the ground for denying a transfer is currently set out in item 7 of paragraph 3 of the IRTP did not seem to work, and that's why we felt, you know, we made some suggestion, you know, in line with the letter as well as spirit of the policy, because if one look at the intention or the whole purpose of the IRTP, I thought the primary or the paramount consideration is about consumer choice. Therefore, that was the overriding consideration, and that's the basis for our suggested amendment. So we currently, I think there were, if you look at the data, the compliance group supplied to the working group early this year, I think the group, we tried to categorize the different types of complaints we received through a 5-month period. And so I saw failure to unlock domain name by a registrar was still a large proportion of the complaints we received, so there was need to have some clarity. So I saw some of the comments on our suggested amendment to that particular ground for denying a transfer. So I'm really a bit struggling to understand that why the group consider that security or the prevention of hijacking or for stolen domain actually would override the consideration for consumer choice or for, say, for example, portability for registrants. So that's something I would like to understand a bit more from this working group. See whether, how do we balance these competing priorities or interests.
Okay, thank you. Pam, what I'll do is I'll throw it open to members of the group who might want to give you some reaction and feedback. So, guys, you have now this wonderful opportunity to give some feedback to Pam. And if you don't put your hands up, I'm going to start picking on people. Paul, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, hi, Pam. It's Paul Diaz from Network Solutions. Okay, where to start with this? I'm still not understanding where ICANN staff is coming from with this. The IRTP currently only lists 9 reasons that a name can be denied transfer, right? If we understand your proposal properly, you're saying delete number 7 because it's, quote, superfluous.
Yeah.
All right. In deleting number 7, which is saying that the name was already in lock status, seems to be ignoring the reality that in today's marketplace, the steady state for almost all registrars is to have the domain name under a lock status as a basic security precaution. Remember, of course, that when the IRTP was put in place, we changed the rules that the registrant no longer has to give affirmative consent to the transfer. Basically, it goes after 5 days. So registrars determined that the safest way to make sure that, simplest way, I should say, to make sure that names are not hijacked was to lock them. If we follow staff's advice and eliminate rule number 7, that's effectively going to take away the security, the basic security that registrars have put in place. And as I look at it, it would also undo the recent trend for registry operators to offer their own locks, because we will no longer have something we can all point to and say it's in lock status. So I don't really understand what consumer choice and all that is about when fundamentally we're talking about the security of our customers' domain names.
Okay. Pam, I'll take people on the queue, and then if Pam wants to come back afterwards, I think her line is a little bit unclear. Daniel Halloran?
Yes, thanks. Good morning, Michele and Paul and Marika and Mark and Pam and everyone else, and good day. And thank you very much for having us here. I want to just start, and I know it's very late for Pam, so she didn't get to give a nice speech, but we very much appreciate the work this group does. This is, I know, very time-consuming and almost thankless work, because, you know, you're kind of toiling away in the dark corners of the GNSO, but we think doing very important work, and we want to thank you for all the attention you put onto this. And first agree with Pam that we think it's, you know, very important the consumer choice angle on this, but we do recognize, and Paul stressed, and we would agree 100% that it's also extremely important that registrants have security and that we don't, let names go flying off without good security procedures and protocols. So this is not a case where we're saying that, you know, consumer choice has to trump all this. We totally recognize that there's a balance to be made, and you're and essentially balancing, you know, how many registrants do we want to inconvenience to prevent one hijacking? Is it worth, you know, 100 inconvenienced registrants to prevent one hijacking, or 5 or whatever? So this is hard work, and there's no right or wrong answers. And so we definitely recognize that. And so, Paul, I want to just jump right in on your points about, we agree with you. We're not trying to undo the idea of registrar lock. I think what our suggestion was was our, when we started making these suggestions and we were asked for feedback, our understanding, or at least mine, was that denial reason 7, domain was already in lock status, was referring to what we've taken in our back and forth to calling an EPP-based lock, or back, I think when this was written, it was an RRP-based lock. So in other words, it's okay not to let a name get transferred out if it's in lock status. And if that's implemented in EPP, then the losing registrar never sees the transfer request. They don't really ever deny a transfer request because the transfer request errors out at the registry level because it says it's in registry lock, a registrar lock. So our suggestion was, based on our understanding of what lock status meant, which was an EPP-based lock, that ground for denial, we recognize that that's a perfectly valid reason for a name not to transfer. And like you said, that's an important security thing lots of registrants want and lots of registrars implement. But we were saying, take that out of the grounds for denial, not delete it, the whole concept entirely, and go ahead and move it, and if you can, provide more clarity around when it's okay for a registrar to put a name into lock status, how the registrant can get the name out of lock status. We agree it should be based on security and on the registrar's good practices, the registrant's consent, basically, to what kind of security the registrant wants on the name. And then that would probably clarify things like, in terms of numbers, grounds for objection number 6, I think would be more clear if we could expand that and treat all the range of issues that I think you guys are talking about, or some of you are talking about, as registrar-specific locks, or I would actually have concerns about treating it that way, because to me, I think if there's going to be a registrar lock, it's clearer to have it be reflected in the EPP, be reflected in WHIS, so that the registrant and other registrars can see, oh, that name is on lock, and I can, and other registrars can give clear guidance to the registrant and say, hey, we see here that your name is on lock, so the first thing you're going to have to do is go to your registrar and get that unlocked. And that provides clarity for registrants and for ICANN, and I think for the registrars. So that's where we're coming from. It's not, let's delete registrar lock, not at all. We're just saying, the way we understood registrar lock, it's supposed to be EPP-based, and therefore there is no denial of transfers because no transfers requests happen. Therefore, that shouldn't be a grounds for denial. It should be treated in some other section where we're going to talk about lock status and how to get on and off lock status and consent and readily accessible means, et cetera. So that's my input on that. And thank you again, Paul and Kelly.
Thanks, Daniel. James and then Mikey.
Hi, it's James speaking, and I just wanted to thank Dan because he basically expressed a lot of what I was intending to say, which is that there's really no right or wrong answer here, just that it's a question of balance, and we are trying to strike that balance between portability and consumer choice on the one hand and security on the other hand. I think the registrars, especially the ones that participate in ICANN and in this group, are in favor of domain name portability and consumer choice because we all believe very strongly that given a choice, consumers will choose our services. But we've also seen the other side of that. Hijackers are very, very smart, maybe devious is a better description. And, you know, we have to be very cognizant that registrars should be enabled to respond on behalf of the customers and victims of hijacking that maybe perhaps are not their customers yet. And, you know, we need to make sure that we have a lot of tools in place, and I think that the EPP lock is just one of those things, EPP lock and some forms of internal locks if they're associated with different security products that prevent unwanted or unauthorized transfers. So I think it is important that we maintain a strike and balance. I do want to point out one thing in the feedback here that was noted in item 4 that, you know, some of these terms and conditions are buried in the registration agreement, and the word is buried. And I just wanted to point out that we're reaching a tipping point here where registrars are continuously being asked to compensate for the lack of community education by including more and more disclosures into our registration agreements, and then we have to turn around and respond to accusations that we're burying things in the registration agreement. And I just would like to perhaps put that bug in staff's ear that we find that as more and more of these issues, working groups are putting or burdening the registration agreements with more and more requirements, in addition to things coming from other directions like law enforcement and legislation. Maybe we should step back a little bit from saying, these registration agreements are becoming very arcane and, Byzantine, and we really need some community education to get around some of the cumbersome language in these. I don't know if that made sense, but I see a trend here where we're just going to continue to overload registration agreements, and then we're going to continue to say that that's not enough, that we need something a little more conspicuous.
Okay, thanks, James. Mikey?
Thanks, Michele. This is Mikey O'Connor, and thanks to Dan and Pam and Mike and all the others for joining us today. I'm a registrant type guy. That's my point of view in all this. Just to give you especially for Pam, who I don't think we've met. My view is pretty closely aligned with the registrars and the registries in that we want to be very careful. The balance is absolutely correct. We certainly want to balance portability with security, but I never thought of IRTP as really having much, if anything, to do with consumer choice until this morning. So I'd like to hear more about that. My view of IRTP is that this is really much more a technical process than a consumer choice process. And the issue with the lock status stuff is historically arose from a losing registrar that would essentially hold on to a domain name by keeping it locked. So I guess I'd like to hear more about the consumer choice argument, because that's a new one for me. Thanks.
Okay. Daniel?
Yes, thank you, Michele, and Mikey, thank you for that. I'll do a little more talking, and then maybe Pam can jump back in, because I'm unfortunately going to have to leave pretty soon because I've got three kids and need to get to school. But, fundamentally, the consumer choice is all about just what you just mentioned, that if you're the registrant and you've got a name at Registrar X and you've become dissatisfied with Registrar X's price or service, or Registrar Y has sent you an offer and they want you to come to that registrar and you want to go to that registrar, the first thing you're going to need to do is get your name unlocked so you can move it. And you, the registrant, I think that's what this policy is all about, both choice and security, that we need to, if the policy was perfect, you could always transfer your domain as soon as you wanted to, as conveniently as possible, with no hassle and no trouble. At the same time, if the policy was perfect, your name would never be hijacked and your name would never, ever transfer against your will without your consent. And so the whole policy is about trying to get as close to that ideal as we can, where you never have a frustrated consumer and you never have a hijacked consumer. And really, consumer choice is what the whole thing boils down to, and I agree with Pam's stress on it. We do get more complaints on the side of frustrated complainants, frustrated registrants who want to go to a different registrar because they're not happy with the price or service they're getting, or they think they can find better price and service. And they call ICANN and they say, hey, I can't move. My registrar has this confusing thing, or they're stonewalling me, or I don't understand it. And we have to deal with those calls. Now, totally, and not, again, I agree it's a balancing. And I personally would rather deal with 5 or 10 or maybe even 100 calls from upset consumers who are having difficulty figuring out their current registrar's transfer procedures than to deal with one telephone call or one letter from lawyers basically, it's a panic and emergency situation when a registrant gets his name hijacked, and all of a sudden, his business is down, his email is down, his domain is at some other registrar, might be in a different country with different who is, and it's really an ugly situation. And I think, as probably a lot of the registrars who are on this call could say, you'd rather deal with 10 or 100 customer complaints than one hijacking.
This is Mikey again. Let me just follow up for a second. I think that we agree, Dan. And so when, if we then circle back around to the approach of deleting denial 7, that seems, you know, I mean, part of this is that we're dealing in double and sometimes triple negatives. And I get confused, but isn't denial reason 7 all about what you just described? And that the issue that we're trying to resolve is to make it clearer?
So, Mike, yes, this is Dan again. So I agree. It's confusing, and I'm sorry that it was difficult. We tried back and forth on email through Marika, and we tried to come on the call to clarify, but there's no simple way. We're into the weeds of the grounds for denial and the negatives of the non-reasons for denial. It is kind of a mess. But fundamentally what we're saying is just because of the way the registry and registrar software works, if a domain is in registrar lock status, as we understand it, which some people are calling an EPP-based lock, that's visible in the Whois, it's visible in EPP, and there's no way a gaming registrar can initiate a transfer on that domain. And since there's no way to initiate a transfer, there's no need or reason to deny a transfer. And since there is no such, you know, under that understanding, a transfer request would never be denied because of registrar lock status. And that's why we said, what's in number 7 there does not belong under reasons for denial, because a transfer would never be denied because a transfer would never be initiated. So we're saying keep those rules, keep the ability to have registrar lock status, just move it out and just explain, and if you can, elaborate on the rules and clarify exactly what's needed. It might even be this is just a drafting thing and you guys look at it a long time and look at the complaints and analyze it from both sides and decide the balance is kind of where it should be and you don't want to move it on the substance. So the first thing was just a drafting point that, as we understood lock status, lock prevents transfers from happening, and therefore you don't need a transfer denial reason called domain was in lock status.
Michele, just want to put myself on the queue very quickly. Paul has put on the chat there a question that I personally would love to have an answer to as well. The question is, does compliance have any sense of the breakdown in customer complaints, i.e. the registrar is stonewalling me versus I don't understand what I have to do to transfer my name? And as a registrar, it's my sense the lack of education is more common than non-compliance with the IRTP. What Paul is asking is pretty much a question that I would love the answer to as well. So, does anybody from ICANN staff know? I mean, do you have data that can actually show the difference between, you know, the registrar is stonewalling me because the registrar is literally stonewalling you, or just the case of the registrant is confused and doesn't know what they're meant to be doing? Anybody from ICANN staff like to jump in here?
Pam, are you still on the line?
Bailey, this is Mike Zupp. My thoughts on that.
Please, go ahead.
The thing of it is that get to ICANN, they typically, they're already frustrated, so they pretty much assume that the registrar is stonewalling, whether the registrar is or not. So I think that, you know, the accusation, you know, the strength of the accusation isn't necessarily reflective of whether or not it's a genuine compliance issue.
Okay.
Dana, it might be that Pam has dropped off the line, and I think Pam is sort of the keeper of the complaints data, and so it might be that it's best if we could follow up with Pam.
Yeah, I think Pam is still on the line, but she has been muted, I think, by the operator. So, Saba, can you please unmute Pam's line?
Or if that doesn't work, maybe just we could commit that to come, you know, Pam could come back to, through Marika with whatever data we can uncover. Because it is an interesting question. It might be that we just have a category of complaints that I'm having trouble transferring my name away. And then there's another layer of detail on that, which is what Paul's asking about, is this the customer just plain doesn't understand, or is it that there's some kind of active frustration being caused by the registrar? It might be a little hard to untangle that in some cases, which actually this does sort of relate to what we were talking about in terms of untangling number seven, ground for denial seven from ground for denial six, and that. I mean, I personally think it would be clear if in every case, if the registrar was going to rely on the lock status, that it was EPP-based, and the registrant and other registrars and ICANN could all see, oh, this name is in lock. I can see it right here in the who is status, and not have it based on some kind of hidden or murky or secret registrar-based lock that's not apparent to other people outside that registrar.
Just Michele here. Just with respect to this thing about the secret lock type scenario, I would agree with you 100%. And it's something that I personally have always felt should be displayed in Whois. For whatever reason, if there is some kind of lock, it should be displayed in Whois. Pam is back. If you would like to, if you could try to answer that query, it would be helpful.
Okay. Can I just repeat the question so we'll make sure I understand it correctly? The question was how many complaints we receive, or percentage of complaints we receive, really was about registrant do not understand the transfer policy. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. I suppose the question is, are you able to capture the difference between I'm a frustrated user and I don't understand what's going on, versus the registrar I am using is a scumbag who does not want to release my domain name. Breaking it down into really blunt terms.
Well, I don't understand. Well, 9% of the complaints we received, we group that as registrants who do not understand the transfer process.
Okay.
And 15% of the complaints we received over that 5 months period, when we're talking about the same set of data, is about registrars who failed to unlock the domain name. So we're talking about this particular issue about locking and unlocking. So I would say, yes, there are 9% of people who simply don't know even there's such locking mechanism. And it goes back to the question, I think, about the whole debate, whether what IRTP is all about, the purpose of the IRTP. And I got the sense consumer choice is the paramount consideration based on a very early report in 2003 by the final report and recommendations of the GNSO Council on the transfer task force. And if you read through that document, to me, it was abundantly clear it's all about consumer choice.
Okay. Does anybody else have any other queries for Pam?
Michele, this is James.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm not in the queue. I stepped away from my desk for just a moment, but I did have a question for Pam and for the rest of ICANN staff, and that is that, the consideration that IRTP is all about consumer choice and the ability of a registrant to vote with their feet, if you will, and move their names to the registrar of their choice, I think is important. Do they have any sort of thoughts on the reality of the secondary market where IRTP is also used to facilitate a change of registrant or change of control in transferring one name to the other? Is that an appropriate use of IRTP?
This is Dan. I don't know if Mike or Pam can also jump in on this. I mean, my initial thought was I saw some discussion about this either on I was looking through the list or maybe it was in the report or the comments, and actually went back and looked at the transfer policy, and then I went back and looked at the old transfer policy, which I don't know if anyone on the call remembers, but it used to be, I think, an exhibit to the RRA for the ComNet.org registry. I'm talking back in 1999, 2000. And the old transfer policy, there was a section that specifically dealt with when a registrant change happens at the same time as an inter-registrar transfer and what the requirements were, and that is now not in the current transfer policy. So it could be that it definitely is something worth the group looking into and exploring whether that needs to be put back in or rules need to go around it. Basically, the old rule used to say something like, if you're the gaining registrar and you're processing both a registrant change of registrant and a inter-registrar transfer at the same time, you need to have, in addition to the authorization from the contact, you need to also have something like a court order or a bilaterally signed agreement between the old registrant and the new registrant. And so maybe some of that is still implied here, but it's not stated unless I'm missing it on my quick review and my late night look and my early morning discussion here. And I will send around a link to the, what I'm talking about, the old RRA.
Okay, thank you. Paul Diaz, please, go ahead. James, jump the queue. James, you consider yourself slapped.
Thanks, Michele. A couple thoughts. Thank you, Pam, Dan, and Mike, for being on the call today. It really is very helpful to us to get the input. A thought, Pam, please, you know, in the course of these IRTP working groups, this is the second of five that are planned. I keep coming back and having to remind everybody that the IRTP that we're living with was, you know, enacted in 2004, but it was developed over the 2 years prior to that. So, you know, when I guess respectfully, I would say let's not overemphasize consumer choice. That was the burning issue back in the 2001-2002 timeframe, and the folks who worked on the new IRTP at that time really did address that. You know, here's what we have. But in the 7 years since, the market has evolved pretty dramatically, and the concerns that people had coming into the beginning of the competitive era to where we are today, you know, I think we have to be very cautious about not holding consumer choice up to such a high level and ignoring what I think most people would agree in today's world, security is at least the equal, if not more important. Anyway, just one question, you know, for staff, really, as this working group continues its efforts, we've touched on the education issue, or at least recognize we need to do some more thinking about it. And it just strikes me that the some of the things that have been suggested today make a lot of sense, suggested by staff may make a lot of sense. But ultimately, there's going to be a very important educational component in any of this effort. It's very clear to me as a representative of one of the larger registrars that there's tremendous misunderstanding about what's involved. And, you know, just for the group, and we'll come back to staff once we start kind of getting a little tighter ideas about what our recommendations will be. But putting too much emphasis on just because something's EPP compliant, you can see it in WHOIS, that alone is not going to come close to educating the very large section of the customer base that doesn't get it. They don't understand how to read or interpret what is in WHOIS. Ultimately, when you know their transfer request fails, it fails at the registry level, they're still going to be calling ICANN. They'll be calling the gaining registrar. They'll be calling anybody saying, hey, somebody's blocking my name. When in fact everything is being done in a perfectly compliant manner with the rules. So while there's definitely a lot of good stuff being offered, you know, I just think we have to be careful not to be too comfortable with, well, if it's EPP compliant, that's going to somehow work out a lot of the concerns and frustrations that folks have with IRTP. But again, thank you for the inputs. It really helps to have staff on these calls more frequently.
Thank you, Paul. Mike, you made it onto this call, so do you have any particular views on this entire section, as you would be one of the people, I assume, who does have to handle some of the complaints from the public?
Thanks, Michele. You know, I don't kind of late this discussion, so I don't think I have a whole lot that you know that I can add. I hope to you know be more of a resource if I can, but I don't think I have anything you know to add that hasn't already been said by Pam or by Dan.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions, queries, comments, thoughts, or anything else to raise with Pam, Daniel, or Mike? Daniel, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Just to say thank you. I have to leave, unfortunately, now. I have three kids under 10 who need to get to school. So thank you all very much again for your work and for having us on the call this morning. Goodbye.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for making it onto the call. Does anybody have any queries or questions or comments or anything to raise with ICANN staff now that we have them on the call? So don't turn around as soon as next week and go, I wanted to say something to Pam Little and I didn't. You now have the opportunity. Paul, go ahead.
Pam, just a general question for compliance staff. Any of the audits that you guys have underway or in the near term, could you just remind us what the schedule is so that we can kind of determine if there will be some perhaps new or fresher data that might be made available to this group while we're still deliberating?
So I think Marika shared with you some of the findings from the beta audit we carried out in May 2010. At the moment, there is the first round of formal audit underway. The notices have gone out to all the registrars who will be audited. I think there were 18 of them that went out early this month. And the due date for their response will be the 23rd of September. We only intend to roll out one round of formal audits the remainder of this year or during 2010. There will be another round of formal audit in the first half of 2011.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
Hi, Pam. This is Mikey again. In your feedback number one, the lack of definition of readily accessible and reasonable means, I'm not sure that I want to focus only on this one, but this is a good example. And my question is, what could we do as the IRTP team to help you clarify that? I mean, we agree that we need to work on that. Do you have any sort of a wish list of things that you'd like to see or that you'd like us to consider while we're thinking about all this?
Yeah, I think I thought our feedback was it is very difficult to come up a, you know, one-size-fits-all definition of what is readily accessible and reasonable means, because it depends on the registrar's specific mechanism or practices or process.
Hello?
Yep. I thought that was our feedback to the working group. We didn't feel that was, I guess from the compliance enforcement perspective, it would be good to have a clear definition what is readily accessible and what is reasonable means, right? But we do appreciate it is difficult to come up with a definition would fit all the practices.
This is Mikey again, Pam. I guess the reason I asked you that is because a lot of times folks like you and your group who are on sort of the front lines have ideas about what those could look like. And if you do, I think we'd be very interested in seeing some of those.
Right. I guess, for me, it would be something that, like a online interface that people can use. I think I've seen some of the register, for example, in the first round, the beta audit we carry out in May, they did have that kind of mechanism in place. People can just log on, to their website or web-based interface tool. They could then do the locking and unlocking themselves. But it's very hard to say that mechanism versus another one. It will be appropriate in a particular setting.
Okay, thanks, Pam.
Matt Serlin?
Thanks, Michaela. It's Matt Serlin from Mark Monitor. Just want to kind of provide a couple comments here on some of the topics that we've been going through in the list in front of us. Essentially agree with with basically everything on this list of bullet points, I think to Mikey's point about readily accessible and reasonable means, I think we as a community, and whether or not it's the work of ICANN compliance or part of the work that this work group is charged with, but I think coming up with some sort of guidelines to define that is a good thing. The only thing that I want to sort of caution on is point number four here, and while I'm supportive of having some sort of publication of high-level security policies or things like that, I want to caution about providing a blueprint, essentially, for would-be hijackers and other folks that are going to commit nefarious acts on domain names that, I personally, and speaking for my registrar, I wouldn't want to put a set of criteria as to how we lock domains, how we unlock domains, how you go through the process, because it part of what at least from my standpoint gives us a higher level of security is the fact that it isn't necessarily crystal clear. People can't go out to our website right now and see exactly, what policies we have for our clients and how they go about unlocking domains. And frankly, that's on purpose. And it gives us an extra level of comfort knowing that there isn't anything out there documented that someone can look at and go, okay, I know how to try to hijack Google.com now, and I go through these steps, and if Mark Monitor misses the boat on one of these, then I'll be good to go. So just a little caution on that point.
Thank you, Matt. Anybody else have any comments, questions, queries? Mikey?
I'm going to go back to the point two. I just want to confirm that it's not that you're disagreeing that the staff is disagreeing with the idea that of this. It's essentially this double negative problem that says that this one is just irrelevant because the circumstance would never arise. Is that a correct understanding?
I think that's the correct understanding, Mikey. So we are saying it's okay to have whatever lock mechanism registrars, see fit in the particular circumstances. But it's just I think our debate was about whether that require upfront informed consent or not, and whether, how the lock and unlock mechanisms should be made available to registrants if registrants going to introduce those locks. So, and whether it's really, to me, echoes what Dan has said. That provision or that particular ground for refusal seemed to be sitting in the wrong place, because you can actually expand item 6, as Dan has pointed out, because to me, lock is just another written objection or express written objection. That you can call it a log, you can call it a written objection, whatever it is. It's just a contractual, a binding a promise that you don't do a certain thing or you'll do a certain thing. And that could be, expanded by changing or amending item 6 of paragraph 3. And then 7 can be moved somewhere else to just deal with registrar lock and how registrar should provide, the reasonable opportunity, registrant reasonable opportunity to unlock the domain name.
Thanks, Pam. This is Mikey. Just one follow-up for the team, I think, and that is we probably need to take a look at scope and see whether, if we were to do that, we've stepped outside the boundaries of the scope of our charter.
To do what exactly, Mikey? Sorry.
Moving this outside, the shifting of things. I haven't got the policy in front of me because I'm at the wrong computer today, but...
Okay, could you put your thoughts on this maybe in an email to the list?
Yeah.
It might be easier, more concrete and easier. So I don't know about anybody else, but there seems to be so many emails flying around at the moment, it's very hard to follow. And no, I don't mean in this relation to this list, I mean in relation to the other ones. Matt, again?
Yeah, thanks, Michele. I just kind of wanted to pick up on Mikey's point and essentially back up what staff has put here. And from a registrar standpoint, I can confirm and you know, their interpretation of this reason 7 is correct, in that if a domain name is on registrar or registry lock, a gaining registrar cannot even submit a transfer request to the registry, so that there technically is no denial ever required for a domain that's on lock. So I do agree that it is superfluous. I think maybe we just need to, you know, redraft the wording or look at how it's or how it's worded. But from a pure technical standpoint, that is 100% correct.
Marika, and then Paul.
It is, Marika. I'm just looking at the charter question itself, and basically it says whether, and if so, how to best clarify denial reason 7, and then the title. I mean, I think there's some flexibility, because if the group decides that clarifying it means moving it or deleting it and, you know, replacing it with clearer language, you know, in my view, I think that fits with that description. But, you know, I think once the group comes up with a recommendation, it's something we can definitely check back with the council or verify with legal counsel how far we can go. But as it's currently framed, I think there is some room for maneuver.
Okay, thank you, Marika. Paul?
Thanks, Michele. You know, guys, I think I have a different view on this one. I think the importance of number 7 is there for the losing registrar, because consider the very, very common occurrence where somebody wants to transfer their name. It's in an EPP lock, so the request goes, it is shot down at the registry level, nothing happens. So now the customer is mad, they call in and say, why didn't you let my name go? The response is simply, rule number 7, it was in a lock status. Now you can work with the registrant at that point to take the lock off, let it go, etc. But that number 7 is in there ultimately so that the losing registrar can say, we're still compliant with the policy.
I see lots of hands going up. Mikey, try to keep this to the point, no offense, and then Matt.
I think the deal here, Paul, is that this one would never happen. And so what we're saying, I think we're all saying that we want to keep the intent. We just want to move it to a different place in the policy, because the way the policy is written right now, it would never be invoked here. So that we would leave the crutch for the registrar to say it's in the policy, but frame it in such a way that it can actually happen. Because what I understand now is denial reason 7 is like a branch in a computer program that can never be run down.
Okay, Mass, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll be brief. I think we really are sort of getting into semantics and splitting hairs, because Paul, in your example, the point we're trying to make is that the losing registrar didn't actually deny anything. The request never got to them because the domain was the transfer from the gaining registrar never actually made it to the registry because it's locked. So I agree with you that rationale for a transfer not being successful is important, and I think it probably, just to Mikey's point, needs to be reworded or put in a different place in the policy, but it is not. It just isn't a flat-out denial. The losing registrar can't deny it in that case because it doesn't get to them. So I think we're all saying the same thing. I just think we need to sort of dive into it a little bit more.
Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts, queries, questions on any of the feedback or any of the other matters?
Michaela, it's Pam. I have a question, if I may, after everyone.
Yeah, please go ahead. This is why we want people like you on the call, so we can talk to you.
Sure. So when we are thinking about how we can actually combine items 6 and 7 of paragraph 3, maybe we can look at, I will invite the working group to look at item 6, which currently says one of the background for refusing a transfer request is express written objection to the transfer from the transfer contact. So when I was trying to enforce or handle some of our complaints, I was always wondering, is item 6 intended to have a one-off objection to a pending transfer request, or a sort of open-ended, such as the lock status intended to do? objection. So maybe we can actually split six into two scenarios, where there will be a one-off objection, and then there will be some sort of standing objection for an indefinite period or a fixed period. Then the lock status for me is to just have an indefinite period until the lock is removed. So maybe that's one way of, you know, addressing this, because at the moment, to me, it is unclear whether item six is intended to cover objection as a one-off objection or a standing objection.
Any thoughts on this question? Any comments, guys? Mikey?
I like the distinction. I think it's a worthy topic of discussion. Might be very helpful.
Very helpful.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Matt?
Thanks for calling me out. I agree with Mikey. I think it probably is. Again, I don't think it's something that we can resolve on the call here today, but I think looking at splitting that out, like Pam suggested, is probably a good exercise.
Okay, then. What would people view, then, as the next steps based on the conversation we've had today with ICANN staff? What would people suggest? Mikey?
I think it would be really helpful for somebody to go through the MP3 and sort of parse out all the pieces of arguments that we made today and kind of assemble them. You know, the double negative problem really has me wrapped around the axle here. And so capturing the major points made, I think there was a lot of agreement and a lot of subtle language that we need to sort through, but I didn't hear any profound disagreements today and a couple of really good paths forward. So that would be what I would suggest.
Okay, thank you. Would anybody like to volunteer for that? Deathly silence.
Well, if no one's willing to volunteer, I'm happy to look at the transcript when it's available and take out the different points of discussion and put them together in a document.
Well, thanks. I mean, if that'd be great, Marika. Maybe some just a few bullet points or something that we can work from. Now, other matters on the agenda that we had was in relation to the ETRP aftermarket. ETRP aftermarket prospective survey, which Bob and Simonetta had been working on, and based on the conversations we had last week. There is obviously a difference of opinion. Does anybody have any thoughts on this and how we can move forward, or should we just dump it completely? Bob?
Yeah, thanks, Michele. Bob Mountain. The only thing, in thinking about this, understand that there's a desire to broaden the survey beyond just the aftermarket folks. In the interest of just making some progress, though, I might volunteer to just begin with the aftermarket folks, with the possibility of expanding this to other cohorts if the group thinks that would merit it. So I'd just like to potentially volunteer that as a course of action for now.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Any comments from others in this group? Mikey?
This is Mikey. I think we need to get to the issue of who sees this survey resolved before we go out, Bob. I get your suggestion, but I'm not sure that we should do that. I think that Matt's point is well taken, and we need to wrestle that one to ground. I'm not sure we have time on the call today to do it.
Okay, I think maybe it's something we should take up on the next call, possibly. So I think there is a certain degree of trying to, haggle and discuss this further. Okay. Any other business? Any other queries, questions, other topics? Anybody wants to raise? Going once. Going twice. Okay. Meeting adjourned. Speak to you all next week. Have a nice week. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michaela.
Cheers.
Thanks, Michaela.
Bye.
Thank you.